We're in the book of Acts. We've been in it for several months. So turn to the book of Acts on your iPad, iPhone, even a Bible would be great. If you have an iPhone, turn off the sound, turn up Acts chapter 10. And it's a seismic, world-changing event we're going to take a look at here today. You know, when they started the church, which I think, you know, we still wonder about, like, who are we going to let in? We open the doors. Who are we going to let in this place? Who are we going to let in the church? Who can be part of God's kingdom? That's a big question. I remember one church I worked in many years ago. This couple came in, and they were coming in for some counseling, and we were talking, and the guy said, well, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm kind of working on that and struggling a little bit, but generally things are going well. And then his wife talked. She said, and I used to be a prostitute, and I just kind of tried to put on my normal pastor face, like, yeah, you know, a lot of people come in here are prostitutes. And I was like, oh, funny, you don't look like a prostitute. Why are they one in my head? I don't know. But I always loved the fact that I could look out, and here's this ex-prostitute and this guy who's struggling with alcohol addiction, and they were the sweetest people in our church. They were probably growing spiritually the fastest, and I always remember him saying, you know, I'd get more done on my relationship with God than on Sunday mornings than any other day of the week. But I thought, you know, that's what some people would think, is if you open the doors and let anybody in, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get prostitutes and alcoholics and people who are screwed up. And do we really want those kind of people in the kingdom? Because, you know, when the church started, it was just Jews, and they didn't, you know, have some of that behavior. It was all internal, but it didn't look like that externally. So the church started out, and it's like, well, we want to be separate. We want to be different. We don't want to be those. Are we going to allow those kind of people in? And at the time, there's only two kinds of people in the world. There's Jews, and there's everybody else. And what are those people called? Those are called Gentiles. Gentile is a non-Jew. It's everybody else. And they're saying, we don't want those people. We don't want those Gentiles because they have all these weird behaviors, and they come from all over, and they don't look like us. They don't sound like us. I remember back in the 60s, I guess it was, there was a movie called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And it was a big groundbreaking movie because it was about a white girl dating a black guy. And then, I went to Dallas Seminary at the time. I think there was one African-American student. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't common. And then I remember watching this movie this year called The 100-Foot Journey. And it's a story about an Indian family coming to move to France. And they build this restaurant right across from this really special restaurant. And the French people are like, we don't want those kinds of people around here. We don't want those Indians here. We don't want them doing stuff. We certainly don't want to compete with them for our restaurant business. Now, if you're in Rwanda today, you look at somebody and you might ask if they're a Christian or not. But you also wonder, are you a Hutu or a Tutsi? And in fact, that's been the problem 20 years ago was when they placed their tribal identity above their Christian identity. So we all tend to look at groups of people and whether they're like us or not and whether we like them or not and whether we want them to be part of this deal that we think of as God's kingdom. And God always, he created, in a sense, the Jews. He talked to Abraham. He said, Abraham, you're going to be a blessing to the whole world. And then he got them out of Egypt, you know, and then Christian Baal brought them out of Egypt. And then they're out there, and he gives them the law and this whole culture. And he does want them to be different. But in their minds over time, they said, we're going to be different, and we're going to be the only ones. And God's going, no, I do, I have blessed you, and I do want your lifestyle to be holy and all that, but the whole point of this deal is to reach everybody through you. In Isaiah 42 and Isaiah 49, God says, you, Israel, are going to be a light to the Gentiles. They're all going to come in one day. So I'm doing something through you for them. That was always the plan, but it was easy for the Jews to think, you know, this is just really for me. And it's kind of easy for us to kind of get that feeling too. Like, once God has blessed me, then I'm going to put up the walls. Okay, now that we get everybody else in here, you know, we don't want anybody else. I remember when I lived in Colorado, there was kind of the feeling like, okay, we got here to Colorado. We don't really need any of those other Californians or people like that around. In fact, I mean, if you go to Mecca today, you go to the city of Mecca, which I wouldn't recommend because it says, if you're not a Muslim, do not come in. There's a big sign on the road that says, point this way and that way. If you are not a Muslim, do not come into Mecca. You know, the best thing that can happen to you, if you do, is you get deported. Now, in the temple, in the first century, if you walked in as a Jew, there was a big sign saying, this is the court of the Gentiles, don't come any further. It even said, by penalty of death. So, it was fairly clear to the Gentiles, we're not really welcome. We can go into a certain point, and then beyond that, we are really, really not encouraged to go. We're told, don't go. And so this event that happens, it changes all of that overnight. And so we're looking at Acts chapter 10. We're in the middle section. Again, Acts 1:8 is the key to the whole book. You'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem. And then Judea and Samaria are just outside of Jerusalem. And that's the second part. And then the ends of the earth. In the first section, first seven chapters, Peter is kind of the ringleader. And last week we looked at the fact that Paul became a Christian. But now it's kind of switched back to the adventures of Peter for a couple more chapters. Paul's going to kind of take over the book starting in chapter 13. But they've sent him home and said, you know, go home to Tarsus. Don't call us, we'll call you. Stay there for like 10 years. Seriously. So now it's the adventures of Peter. At the end of chapter 9, he's doing some very exciting things. I mean, his life has gotten to be very exciting. He doesn't know what's going to happen next. And we show this map. He goes from Jerusalem to Lydda, and there he finds this lame man, and he heals him. And then he goes to Joppa, and he finds this woman named Tabitha, whose Greek name is Dorcas. And, you know, some churches have the Dorcas Guild, where these women make all these things. It comes from this. And this is the end of chapter 9. I can't go into it in too much detail, but this woman named Tabitha, or Dorcas, she is dead. And Peter raises her from the dead. In fact, he only says one letter difference from how Jesus raised a child from the dead. Jesus said, Talitha kumi, which means little child, get up. And Peter looks at this woman and says, Tabitha kumi, get up. Elijah and Elisha both raised people from the dead. Jesus raised several people from the dead. Peter is now raising people from the dead, at least one, and Paul's going to raise somebody from the dead. So it's simply showing that Peter is a spokesperson for Paul. For Jesus. He's doing the kind of thing that Jesus did. And so it's very adventurous and very exciting, and so he goes off to Joppa. Remember Joppa? Just a few months ago, how could you forget Joppa? You know, with Jonah? Jonah goes there to get away from God, and he gets on the ship with all these Gentile sailors, right? Notice how that they all kind of turn to God. Well, that's the same town. On our trips to Israel, we usually go to Joppa. Here's an aerial view of it. And 30 miles up the coast is Caesarea. Caesarea was built to honor Caesar, and Herod the king made these amazing buildings there. That some of them are still there. Here's this amphitheater that we can go into. You can hear everything. Here's an aqueduct. Brings water like 10 miles away. It's just perfectly engineered so the water gets not too much, not too little, you know. And then here's chariot races on the seashore. No, it doesn't get any better than that. Just go, hey, let's go to the beach and watch some stuff happen, you know. It's like the Cowboys or whatever. Jerry Jones would have built that place up. Kind of like that. He would have loved it. And so this is where these things happen, in Joppa and Caesarea, these two places. So this is the longest narrative in the whole book of Acts, and you're going, oh, man. I'm going to go through it very quickly, and I'm not even going to tell you half of it. So it's in chapter 10. It gets repeated in chapter 11. But it's a fantastic story about God making a major change in who he lets into the kingdom, and it's very good news for the people in this room. If you're Jewish, you have Jewish roots, you know, you're kind of like, ho-hum, we were already there, but now there's a big change. It was about this time that King Herod, that's a little further ahead than I wanted to go. That was chapter 12. At Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion in what was known as the Italian regiment. I like one of the other translations said Italian battalion. Roman legion was 6,000 guys. A cohort was 600. And then a centuria was, guess, 100. So a centurion was in charge of 100 soldiers. And by the way, if you notice, most of the time, especially in the Gospels, when a centurion shows up, he's in a good light. He's often responsive to God, you know? And then there was a centurion where Jesus was on the cross, and he goes, well, this man must have been the Son of God. So they're really stable guys. They're in charge of a significant number of men. They're kind of the backbone of the Roman army. Centurions. He and all his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. One day at about 3 p.m, which was a typical time to pray, he had a vision. He distinctly saw an angel of God who came to him and said, Cornelius! Now I'm going to fast forward a couple thousand years and show you a story that happened a couple years ago that's uncannily similar. Because, you know, sometimes we read these things back in the Bible days and we go, well, that happened then. Does that ever happen now? This is from a book called Dreams and Visions. It's written by Tom Doyle. He's from this area. He went to Dallas Seminary. He's worked in the Middle East. And he writes about some things that he saw happen. You're the one. A woman's shout broke above the pandemonium of Cairo's Friday market. You're the one. Kamal Assam spun toward the voice, his eyes fixed on the black hijab walking towards him. A female hand protruded from the full body covering, pointing in his direction. Yes, you. Instincts begged him to ignore this culturally dangerous assault and dissolve into the crowd. If the woman's husband were anywhere near and saw her approach, she, and likely Kamal, would pay a steep price for this outburst. Kamal couldn't fathom why an observant Muslim woman would choose today to potentially ruin his life. Then a calmer voice inside suggested this might be the very reason that he'd made his unusual trip to the marketplace. You were in my dream last night, she said. The woman, now close enough to be heard without shouting, breathed heavily from the effort of pushing through the mob and from her own shock at the circumstances. Those clothes, you were wearing those clothes, for sure it's you. Kamal instantly recognized why this person had so passionately invaded his life. He said, was I with Jesus? She said, yes, Jesus was with us. What had happened, what had begun as an atypical visit for him to the Friday market, had just taken an even more uncanny and exciting turn. That morning, while reading his Bible, Kamal felt a compelling urge to leave the house where he was staying and venture to the Friday market, which is in the heart of Egypt's capital city. The woman continued, her name was Noor. Jesus, in this dream, he walked alongside me by a lake, and he told me how much he loves me. The woman in black told Kamal details of the vivid dream she'd had the night before. I think my husband loved me at one time, but that love I felt in my dream, his love, was different than anything I've ever experienced. I've never felt so much peace in my heart. I didn't want to leave. I didn't want him to leave. I asked this Jesus, why are you visiting me, a poor Muslim mother with 8 children? And all he said was, I love you, Noor. I've given everything for you. I died for you. The din of the market faded from Kamal's consciousness. He only heard her describing her otherworldly encounter with Jesus Christ. As he turned to leave, the last thing Jesus said was, she's telling about her dream, ask my friend tomorrow about me. He will tell you all you need in order to understand why I visited you. But Jesus, who is your friend? I pleaded in my dream. Here's my friend. Jesus pointed behind us. He's been walking with us the whole time we've been together. And he points to this guy that was in the dream. Who is this guy she just met? Kamal led Noor out of the main crowd to the edge of the souk, the marketplace, and a patch of grass. The two sat down before he spoke. Noor, he said, my name is Kamal, and I'm a Jesus follower. I have loved him with an undivided heart for 10 years now, and am honored to have been in your dream. So this Jesus follower in Egypt has this sense that he ought to go to the marketplace, and he does, and this strange woman comes up to him and said, I had a dream, and Jesus was in the dream, and he told me to talk to you. So almost the exact same thing happens here in Acts chapter 10. So I guess God is still alive and doing things, right? This angel comes to Cornelius. He's a God-fearer. A God-fearer is somebody that's attracted to this whole Jewish thing, you know, because there's all these crazy mystery religions in the first century, and you got to have these initiation rites, and there's also multiple gods and everything, and once in a while they would become aware of the Jewish culture and the monotheism, and there's one God, and it's an attractive thing, and they'd say, I think there's something to this. So they're God-fearers, they're all over the Roman Empire, they're seekers, they're interested, they're attracted to God, the God of the Bible. And so this Cornelius is one of those guys, and he saw an angel, said his name, and Cornelius stared at him in fear, which is basically what everybody does when they see an angel. What is it, Lord? He asked, the angel answered, your prayers and gifts to the poor have come up as a memorial offering before God. Now send men to Joppa to bring back a man named Simon, who's called Peter. He's staying with Simon the tanner, whose house is by the sea, which might tell us that maybe Peter's horizons are broadening a little bit. Why? Because you don't hang around with tanners. Why? What's a tanner? A tanner is somebody who deals with the hides of dead animals. Well, Jews aren't supposed to do that. They're not supposed to mess with dead animals and dead bodies and things like that. And so they, this guy is maybe a little bit off the radar, and Peter's going, hey, I think, you know, he's okay. So he's staying with him. When the angel who spoke to him had gone, Cornelius calls two of his servants and a devout soldier who was one of his attendants. He told them everything that had happened and sends them down to Joppa, 30 miles away. All right? So that's Cornelius up in Caesarea sends guys down to Joppa to find Peter. Now, what's going on with Peter? Verse 9, about noon, the following day, as they were on their journey approaching the city, Peter, down in Joppa, goes up on the roof to pray. They don't have like slanted roofs like us, they got flat roofs. If you want to get away from people, from noise, from crowds, you go up on the flat roof where there's a little bit of peace and quiet. And he goes up there to pray. About noon, he gets hungry, and he wants something to eat. And while the meal was being prepared, he falls into a trance. He saw heaven open and something like a large sheet being let down to earth by its four corners. It contained all kinds of four-footed animals, as well as reptiles of the earth and birds of the air. And then a voice tells him, hey, get up, Peter, kill and eat. And Peter goes, excuse me. I'm a good Jewish man. From my young life, I have always known that there's things you eat and things you don't eat. And I know that there's things you do on Saturdays, you know, the Sabbath. You don't do a lot. You don't travel very far. You keep the laws, 614 of them. I've tried doing that. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do. And I know this is a trick question. I'm not supposed to eat those animals. There's probably a pig in there somewhere too. And so he says in verse 14, surely not, Lord. You can't trick me. I've never eaten anything impure or unclean. I'm a Jew. I follow the law. Well, the voice spoke to him a second time. Don't call anything impure that God has made clean. Now, to get it through Peter's head, it happens three different times. This happened three times, and immediately the sheet was taken back to heaven. And Peter's going, well, that was weird. You know, I didn't even eat anything weird. You know, I was getting ready. You know, what caused this? I don't even know. What's going on? The Peter has had a very adventurous life lately. You know, he's always going around and